So today we have the third lecture of the Cheikh Gulabali Bustan, and today's title is from the Chern-Simon theory in Feynman diagrams.
So, you know, for the younger people in the audience, you know, there are a few techniques that you have to master if you want to succeed in science. So the first one is, of course, to plagiarize. And the second one is, and this is a good life skill in altogether, is to learn how to blame others. So if this talk doesn't go well, I hereby blame Pascal, who is sitting here laughing, because this morning he gave us a good series of, a long description of his work on the little disc opera, etc., and it was too lovely, so I didn't have enough time to prepare. I'll repeat to this at the end, you know, possibly. Okay, anyway, now let's start for real. So again, I'm following a handout. Here's a copy on the screen, and let me remind you where we were. So K is the space of knots, but today it's genuinely the space of knots, but generally I mean knotted objects of some kind. A is the associated graded of A, and it comes out to be a space of diagrams, modular relations. Again, in different circumstances, it comes out to be different things, but today, for knots, it comes out to be diagrams like this, so kind of they have a circular skeleton, black, and then purple internal edges, modulus some relations, anti-symmetry, STU, and IHX, okay? And what we seek is an expansion. And there are two reasons. One is sort of the abstract reasoning from the first hour. And the second reason is that this will prove the fundamental theorem of finite type invariants, that every weight systems come from an invariant. In particular, the weight systems coming from Lie algebras come from invariants. So we will construct lots of non-invariants. Anyway, what we seek is an expansion. So a map Z from K to A, which has some nice property relative to the filtration and the gradation. Now, the context, the bigger context, is that if we have a space of knotted objects and it's associated graded, so you know, this arrow here means two different things. One is it's a functor. Okay, it maps a certain kind of spaces to some other kind of spaces. And the other meaning is we seek an expansion. So we actually seek an honest map between this space and its associated graded. Okay? And so this is what I will call topology. This is what I will call combinatorics. And there will be several instances of topology and combinatorics. And the construction of Z is what we will call high algebra, but there is also low algebra. And low algebra is the fact that the combinatorics that occurs here is the combinatorics of various kinds of pictures, and these pictures represent formulas. And we saw yesterday how these pictures, in the case of, these specific pictures, represent formulas that make sense in arbitrary metrized Lie algebras. And they take values in spaces that look like the universal enveloping algebra of this Lie algebra. So sort of somewhat depending on the circumstances. It's low algebra, but it means good things. It means that whenever you choose a Lie algebra, you can compose, and you get invariants of topological objects. And the reason why this was called pi algebra was because it's usually harder. It's even harder algebra, how to find Z. Okay, so this is the general scheme, and within, and what I'm going to do today is actually a deviation from that scheme. So I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about how to construct Z using quantum field theory instead of, or using differential geometry, if you wish, instead of using high algebra. So high algebra will return tomorrow. So here's a formula for Z. Theorem, the following is a formula for an expansion for knots. So let's read the formula. The formula says, so if you have a parameterized knot, and now I call it gamma because I want to insist on a parameterization, it's not just an equivalence class, it's a specific embedding of a circle into R3. Then I define Z of gamma to be the sum over all diagrams D. Now, which diagrams? Exactly the diagrams that appear in the description of A. But the diagrams themselves, not modulo the relation. So sum over diagrams of, for each diagram, you get a numerical coefficient, which is a real number, multiplied by the diagram itself appearing here. So it's a formal linear combination of diagrams. So you can think of it as living in this space A, which the space of formal linear combinations. So actually, now I switch to real coefficients for today. Okay? Now, what is the coefficients that multiplies the diagram D? So there is some combinatorial factor C of D, which I didn't even bother to write, but it's some product of factorials and things like that. I didn't bother to write because I don't remember. I will have to recover it myself if I wanted to write it. Then you have to divide by the number of the automorphisms of D. Again, it's not particularly important. Here is the important thing. This is where the dependence on the knot comes in. So the important thing is the integral over a certain configuration space of a certain differential form. Now let me explain. So the configuration space of a diagram D. So if you specify a diagram D, the configuration space of that diagram inside R3, given a specific knot gamma, is the space of all configurations or of the space of all ways of placing this diagram in R3. So using straight lines for the edges. So the diagram was a combinatorial object, and then the configuration space is a manifold. Well, a manifold, an open manifold, a non-compact manifold. So it's the collection of all ways of putting vertices in R3 corresponding to the internal vertices of the diagram, and vertices on the knot itself. Well, I drew it here not knotted, but it could have been knotted. I just was lazy. Okay? So And vertices on the knot itself are corresponding to the vertices on the skeleton of the diagram, and in such a way so that any pair of points that are connected by an edge are distinct. So when I put these two points in R3, I put them in separate places. Okay? Now, given such a configuration space, from this configuration space, I can define five different maps into S2. Five different maps into the two sphere. Namely, I can look at this edge and pretend that it is oriented. Let's ignore for a moment issues of orientations, okay? So you can consider this edge, and it points in some direction in R3, right? If I have an edge, well, here is an edge, it's pointing in some direction. This direction is really a point in S2, right, in heavens, which is all around us. And I have five edges, so I have five maps into S2, one for each edge. So the integral is an integral over the configuration space, and the integrand is the wedge product over all edges. For each edge, you pull back the volume form of S2 to configuration space using the direction map corresponding to that edge. Okay? Now, let's count dimensions just to see that it makes sense. So what's the dimension? So for this specific diagram, what's the dimension of configuration space? Well, three parameters from here, three from here, one from here, one from here, one from here, one from here. 3 plus 3 plus 4 ones is 10. What's the form degree? So we are wedging together 5 copies of a two form. Or sorry, it's not 5 copies of the same two form. It's the same two form pulled back using different maps. So it's we're wedging together 5 two forms. The total form degree is 10. If you have a 10 form, if you have a 10 form on a 10 dimensional space, you can integrate. Okay? So you integrate, and the claim is that this is the required expansion. Or this is, well, not there because it's not unique, but this is an expansion which has the property you want. So I'm actually not really going to tell you how to prove this, nor how to compute it. I'm only going to tell you both of these things very briefly. But what I really want to do is to sketch where such a horrible formula could have possibly come from. Where did it come from? Okay? But before that, an even sketchier sketch of why is it true? So why is it an invariant? Okay? So the idea, well, is you differentiate with respect to moving the knot, right? So you have this integral. It depends on the placement of the knot. You move the knot around. You move it a bit. And you differentiate. And then you play with everything you know about Stokes' theorem. And you show that the derivative of with respect to moving the knot becomes the integral of a D of a certain form, of the exterior derivative of a certain form on configuration space. And it's very easy to show that that particular form, for dimensional reasons, has to be zero. Except that this is a non-compact space. So there are issues about what happens in it. When you use Stokes' theorem, you get issues at infinity. So even before that, you replace this space by a compactification. And the compactification is very sophisticated, and it's the Fulton-McPherson compactification, but naively, you can think of it, or with just a little bit of loss, you can think of it as declaring that instead of these two points being disjoint, you say, instead of having them be distinct, you allow them to be, or you require that they will be bigger than epsilon away from each other, where epsilon is a tiny, tiny, tiny number. Okay? So by doing so, configuration space gets a boundary. It becomes compact, so you can use Stokes' theorem, but unfortunately, it gets a boundary. And the boundary is when these two points come very, 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 very close to each other, infinitesimally close to each other. Or when this point comes infinitesimally close to that point. Or in fact, when any other edge of the diagram contracts to being infinitesimally short. Okay? And then the Stokes' theorem argument that you had before has a defect corresponding to these contractions. So basically, if you look at pictures that look like the IHX relation, like here, there will be, so if you have three different diagrams representing three different integrals, then the diagram corresponding to I will have a defect when the central edge contracts to nothing. The diagram corresponding to H will have a defect, or the invariance proof will have a defect, when the central edge contracts to nothing, and likewise for x. But you see, when these central edges contract to nothing, these three diagrams become the same. They all become the same quadrivalent diagram, the same diagram with a quadrivalent vertex, which looks like this. The middle is contracted. So it turns out that the defects in the invariance proof coming from this diagram and from that diagram and from that diagram are the same. So you get an a mistake in the invariance, and the mistake in the invariance is proportional to the sum of these three diagrams, right? Because within Z, all diagrams appear, and in particular, those three. So you get a mistake proportional to this sum, but I'm modeled out by the sum, well, with signs. And so therefore, there is no mistake. So that's why we modeled, or that's why from the differential geometric perspective, you have to mod out by this IHX relation. And likewise for the other relations. Okay? So that's a very, very sketchy proof of the proof, a very, very sketchy sketch of the proof. And in fact, it's wrong. There is a certain deeper mistake, and in order to fix it, you have to sort of renormalize the framing anomaly, and some further issue comes up. But they're minor. They're major, but minor relative to what I've just told you. This is the big picture. The big picture is more or less right. End of sketch of invariance. By the way, I gave a class on this like a year or two ago, and it's all on videotape. And you can click on this and on the PDF version and watch this class. And it took, you know, essentially a whole semester to describe the details. So it's not easy, not entirely easy. Okay, the second point that I wanted to make is, how would you evaluate this? Or how would you try to evaluate it? So you see, the same argument, essentially the same argument that shows that you can move the knot around, also shows that you can replace omega, the volume form of S2, by an arbitrary other two form on S2 whose integral is 1. So you can, if you replace omega by d of some one form, it does everything goes through. So you can replace it by an arbitrary two form with integral 1. Well, if you have if you can use an arbitrary two form of integral 1, you may as well pick the two form on S2 which is concentrated at one point. And in fact, you can choose a different point for each edge. And then the integration becomes a counting argument. This is very similar, by the way, to, you know, you can compute the degree of a map by pulling back a form and integrating, or by counting pre-images of a single point. So it's the same principle. So instead of integrating, you can replace everything by counting. So choosing a point for each edge is like choosing stars in heavens, right? Because heavens is in S2, and our edges are supposed to point at these stars, right? So you choose arbitrarily stars in heavens, and then you count all ways of placing the diagram on the knot in such a way that so that the edges point at stars. So, you know, if this is the knot, and then my stars are there, there, and there, then I'm counting the ways of placing the diagram on the knot so that each edge is pointing at one of the stars. Of course, you have to count with signs, you have to be very careful, and you get an equivalent description of the invariant, and there is a proof in this context as well. Now I said that's a way to compute it. Well, not really, because this count is really impossible to do. You can, it's in principle finite and combinatorial, but in practice, if I give you a knot embedded in a specific way, there's no way to really carry out this count. Okay? Maybe accepting one example. So the one example is the case of a knot with two components, so a link, and the diagram you use is this diagram, and then the pairing of this diagram with a knot is the count of how many times you can find a point on one component and a point on another component so that the vector between them points in some specific direction. Now, which direction do you choose? So here is such a two component knot. Which direction do you choose? Obviously, you choose your own I as the star. And then a vector living on one knot and pointing in the direction of the other is what you perceive as a crossing in the planar projection. So you are really counting crossings between the components in the planar projection with sound. And that's the so-called Gaussian linking number. This is something, that's the only subcase which is easy to do. Is this okay? So let's go on and talk about where it all comes from. And, you know, this is literally where it came from, historically speaking. So historically speaking, this whole story comes from reading a paper by Witten from 1988, in which he described how to construct knot invariants from the Chern-Simons quantum field theory. And you know, if you start from the Chern-Simons quantum field theory and play the games that people play in quantum field theory routinely, you simply get the picture I described before. So I want to tell you a tiny bit about Chern-Simons theory and about the games that physicists play routinely. Okay? Is this okay? Good. So what's Chern-Simons theory? So here is Witten's definition of Z of gamma. Okay? So Witten says Z of gamma is the integral dA, where A runs over the space of all G-valued connections, where G is some Lie algebra. But you know, you don't have to think very hard. Since we are on R3, a G connection is just a one form with values in the Lie algebra. So it's a one form, but instead of having values in the reals, it has values in the Lie algebra. Okay? Then, and notice that this is an infinite dimensional integral. We're integrating over a highly infinite dimensional space, the space of all one forms. So I will have to explain what this means, and the explanation is the whole point. Okay? Now, what is the integrand? So one piece of the integrand that we'll discuss later, and the primary piece is the exponential of the Chern-Simons action. What's the Chern-Simons action? So, well, it's on constants times the integral on R3 of a certain 3 form. The 3 form is, so you take this one form here, you take its differential, that's a 2 form. You wedge it with the one form itself, that's a 3 form. But now it's valued, since I took 2 copies of the one form, it's valued, and each one was valued in the Lie algebra, now it's valued in the Lie algebra tensor itself. But remember that I have a metric on the Lie algebra. So if I have something in G tensor G, I can take the inner product of the two sides and I get an element, a real number. So that's what this trace means. The trace means map G tensor G to the ground field, to the reals. Well, but that's not all, because the next thing to do is to take three copies of the one form and call the result, and then you wedge them together, that's A wedge A wedge A. Now, if you wedge together three one forms with values in the real numbers, you get zero. But if you wedge together three one forms with values in the Lie algebra, you get an anti-symmetric tensor in G tensor G tensor G. And, you know, the real numbers R tensor R tensor R, sorry, the anti-symmetric tensors in R tensor R tensor R are trivial. So that's why if these were real value forms, the thing would die. But in G tensor G tensor G, there is room for anti-symmetric tensors. But there is also a canonical one, the structure constants. So you evaluate this against the structure constants, or take the inner product with the structure constant, and that's what the trace means in this context. And you get again a number which you can integrate. Okay? And, okay, so this gives you this gives you a number per one form, and, well, I integrate this number over all one forms. Well, but there is an additional term, and the additional term is the trace of the holonomy of A along the knot. So if you know what the holonomy of a connection is, well, then this is it. If you don't know what the holonomy of a connection is, then I'll describe it very, very, very briefly and somewhat, well, just very, very briefly. So basically, here is a knot. So I have a connection A. So I have a one form A with values in the Lie algebra. Now, the knot has a tangent at any point. So at any point, I can evaluate the one form on the tangent, and I get an element in the Lie algebra. I think I said that it's the trace in some representation R, so I also pick a representation R before starting the process. So if I represent an element of the Lie algebra, this becomes a matrix. So I get a matrix for this point. And then I get another matrix for this point. And then I get another matrix for this point. And then I get another matrix for this point. Okay? And then you take the product of all of these matrices, or more precisely, these are sort of infinitesimal matrices. So you add each one of them to the identity, so they become big, but perturbations of the identity, and then I multiply all of them going around the knot, and then I take the trace, and that's the holonomy. Or at least that's an approximation to the holonomy. The holonomy is what you get when you make it denser and denser, so sort of like Riemann integration, but with products instead of addition. Okay? Good. Again, this is supposed to be very, very sketchy. So at the level of sketch, this should be enough. You know, if you haven't seen this before, I don't expect you to now be able to actually do computations. Okay? But how on earth is this going to be related to the configuration space integrals that I described before? Or how on earth are you going to evaluate such integrals? And this is what I really want to concentrate on, how to compute such integrals. So schematically, what is this integral? Schematically, it's the integral over a linear space of the exponential of something that is quadratic plus a piece which is cubic in A multiplied by something which can be expanded as a polynomial in A. So I didn't quite show how, but it's enough to say that you can, this can be thought of as, can be expanded as a polynomial in A, and then you get some power series in A. So what I want to understand is how to integrate, in general, the exponential of something quadratic perturbed by something cubic and multiplied by a polynomial. And in fact, since since infinite dimensional spaces are hopeless, I'll try to do it in finite dimensional spaces. And the hope will be to find formulas in finite dimensions that depends only very, very weakly on the dimension. And once you have a formula that depends very, very weakly in the dimension, you can pretend that you didn't notice and substitute the dimension is equal to infinity. And if you're lucky, the formula still makes sense. So that's the plan. And in fact, these formulas will be the definition of that integral. Okay? So instead of thinking of the integral as it was written before, I will think of an integral on Rn, some finite dimensional space, of the exponential of something quadratic plus something cubic, which I will regard as being small relative to the quadratic thing. So I'll multiply it by some factor epsilon and think of it as being small. So just to explain the notation, so lambda ij is a rectangular array of matrix of numbers, also known as a matrix. And I think I want it to be symmetric and positive definite for this to make sense, but all my computation will be formal, so it's actually irrelevant. And I'm using the Einstein summation convention. So this is really the sum over I and the sum over j of lambda ij times xi xj. So this is really just a general quadratic. And likewise here, lambda ijk is a cubic array of numbers. And lambda ijk, xa, xj, xk is a cubic, a general cubic on Rn. So that's the integral I want to understand. Before understanding it, I have to learn some Fourier analysis. So I know you all know Fourier analysis, but let me remind you very, very quickly how it works. So the Fourier transform does the following thing. So if you have a function f defined on some vector space and with values in the complex numbers, you get a function f tilde defined on the dual of that vector space with values in the complex numbers, and f tilde of a functional is defined to be the integral over the vector space of f times the evaluation of this functional on the point, the integration point. I'm sure you've all seen this. So even if what I'm saying is nonsense, you know it. But you need to know some properties of the Fourier transform, and you only need three. So one, if you evaluate the Fourier transform at zero, you just get the integral of the function, right? Because at zero, this is the exponential of zero, which is one, so you just get the integral of the function. The second property is that the derivative with respect to phi of the Fourier transform is up to some constant which I'm neglecting, so pi's, i's, I don't know what, is simply the Fourier transform of the function f multiplied by the corresponding coordinate. Okay? And the last property is that if q is a quadratic, so if q is a quadratic on a vector space, well, a quadratic on a vector space is always defined by applying by the inner product of some operator L, well, of LV times V, where L is some operator, not inner product, just the evaluation of LV times V, where V is some operator going from V to V dual. But then you can invert this operator, and you get an inverse quadratic, which is defined on the dual vector space. And then the formula is that the Fourier transform of a quadratic is the inverse quadratic. Sorry, of an exponential of a quadratic is the exponential of the inverse quadratic. And again, I'm ignoring signs, and I'm ignoring factors of I, and I'm ignoring pi's and things like that. Mm-hmm. Okay. And by the way, so this is a very easy computation. You it's an exercise. It's really an easy computation. But as an aside, it's the key point in one of the proofs of the Fourier inversion formula. The Fourier inversion formula says that if you apply the Fourier transform twice, you get back where you started. Again, maybe with some reflection or something, but more or less you get back to where you started. And one way to see it is to say that any function is a linear combination of or can be approximated by a linear combination of very, very tight Gaussians. Now, so it's enough to prove the Fourier inversion formula for Gaussians and to understand how Gaussians behave under shifts, which is again easy. And for a Gaussian, if you apply the Fourier transform the first time, you invert the quadratic, and the second time you invert it again, so you get back to where you started. And that essentially proves the Fourier inversion formula. Anyway, these are the only three properties I need to know. And here's how I use them. So, okay. First of all, I expand this part as a power series in epsilon. So I get sum as n goes to infinity of epsilon to the m divided by combinatorics times the integral over Rn of some polynomial, namely the nth power of this, multiplied by the same exponential of quadratic as before. And this is where I evaluate the integral. So evaluating an integral is computing the Fourier transform and evaluating it at zero, right? The integrand is a polynomial times some function. So the Fourier transform of that is the same polynomial applied to the derivatives with respect to the dual variables. Again, applied to this function. And finally, the function under Fourier transform becomes the same thing but with the opposite quadratic form. So altogether, it becomes a sum as n goes from 0 to infinity of some combinatorics times, well, this polynomial becomes a polynomial in derivatives applied to the exponential of the inverse quadratic. So the inverse quadratic is, instead of having the lambda ij's with indices at the bottom, I use lambda ij's with indices above. But all this means is the inverse matrix. And then I look at the quadratic corresponding to this inverse matrix, but I'm using variables t alpha and t beta, which are the dual variables to the xi and xj. Okay, the coordinates in the dual space. Okay? And finally, I evaluate this at all the variables are set to zero. Okay? Now, this looks like a horrible mess, but there is no integration left. Okay? So this is wonderful because, you know, we've essentially evaluated the integral and converted it to combinatorics. Now let's understand this combinatorics. So the next step is, well, I can expand, so you know, I need to differentiate, so these differentiations are with respect to the t's. And I have 3m such differentiations, and I'm applying it to some power series in the t's, and evaluating at t equals 0. The only way I can get a non-zero answer is if the number of t's coming from this power series is equal to the number of differentiations, right? If I, you know, when I expand this exponential as a power series, if I have too few t's, then so if I have fewer than 3m t's, then the differentiation will kill it. And if I have more than 3m t's, then the evaluation at t equals 0 will kill it. So the only way to get a contribution is by taking this differential operator and applying it to the appropriate power here that will give exactly degree 3m. Meaning, I have to find the number L so that 2 times L, because this is of degree 2 and I raise it to the power L, so that 2 times L is equal to 3m, and then I need to evaluate this. Okay, is this clear? So, you know, this is sort of what mathematicians don't like. It's like playing with the details of some messy formulas. But that's where Feynman diagrams come from, if you want it or not, and Feynman diagrams are important. Okay? So, or that's one of the ways they come, and the other ways they come about aren't any easier. Okay? So now let's try to understand this. Here is a good way to understand this differential operator acting on this polynomial. In general, how does a differential operator act on a polynomial? So, you know, let's compute the derivative with respect to x of x to the 4. You probably know the answer, but let me remind you how you do it. So you do the derivative with respect to x of x times x times x times x, and then the derivative picks one of the x and of the x's and annihilates it. So this derivative will pick one of the x's and annihilates it, and there are 4 possibilities, so you get 4 times what remains is x cubed. You know this.
Yeah,
sorry. But now suppose I wanted to do, I don't know, the derivative with respect to x cubed times the derivative with respect to y squared acting on y. I think it's x cubed y squared. How would I compute this? Well, I write it as dy dy, and I write the dx as 3 copies of dx. And then the first y, dy, has to choose one of the y's and annihilates it. The second y has to choose one of the other y's and annihilates it. The first dx has to choose one of the x's and annihilate it. The second dx has to choose. So basically, I have to sum over all such choices of pairing of the differentiation with a variable. Now let's do it, let's organize it in our case. So in our case, so there is combinatorics outside the parentheses, but inside the parentheses, I have, at the bottom, I have those pitchforks, which represent the differential operator. So I have, since this is differential operators raised to the power m, I have m copies of the pitchforks. And each pitchfork is lambda ijk, or lambda i1j1k1, multiplied by the derivative with respect to i1, the i1th variable. The derivative with respect to the jth one variable, the derivative with respect to the k1 variable. And of course, there is an implicit summation here over i1j1k1, just as there was a summation over here inside the parentheses. Okay? So this is the first pitchfork. The same pitchfork is the same. Sorry, the second pitchfork is the same, except I've used different name for the variables just not to be confused. But these are dummy variables. There is an implicit summation on all of the i1, j1, k1, i2, j2, k2, and so on. So this is the operator, and the function being differentiated is, well, the lth power of this, and this is a quadratic, So I take L copies of, I don't know, what is this? A bridge. L arcs, okay? Where each arcs really means lambda alpha 1 beta 1 times T alpha 1 T beta 1. These are the variables. And there is an implicit summation over all of these alphas, okay? And what is the value of the derivative? Sorry. This is the differentiation I want to carry out, but what comes out? What comes out is that each differential operator has to pick each differentiation has to pick a factor, a variable, and then they kill each other, and the pairing has to be complete, or else we don't get an answer. Okay? Now, so there is a sum over all pairings here. Okay? So now I have a terrible threefold summation, right? One summation is over all the alpha betas with all the indices. The other summation is over all the ijks, and the last summation is over all pairings. But there is one reduction, well, some reductions, but the reduction is that you see, if I differentiate with respect to I2, the variable appearing here, I will get zero unless this is the same variable as this, unless I'm differentiating with respect to the right variable. Okay? So the only way to so I will get the contribution only if beta 3 is equal to I2. Okay? So overall, I get a summation of all alphas, all betas, all pairings. But when I pair, it imposes equalities. It imposes that I2 is equivalent to beta, is equal to beta 3, and alpha 1 is equal to whatever it is paired with, and so on. Okay? So by the way, here are some examples of pairings, of possible pairings. And each such pairing, combinatorially, is just a graph. Right? So this graph is combinatorially, it's just a dumbbell, so a graph like this, and that pairing is, if you look at it combinatorially, it's just a tetragraph. So it turns out that the result at the end depends only on the graph that you get. So you can rewrite this as a sum over all graphs of the contribution corresponding to each graph. Now, what's the contribution corresponding to a graph? Well, first of all, the graphs are born with labels, right? Because the graphs are born with labels I1, J1, K1, and so on near each of the vertices. And along each edge, they come with labels alpha 1, beta 1, or alpha 2, beta 2, and so on. So the graphs are born with labels. Okay? So if you have a labeled graph, and you see I really contracted the red pairings to points so that you see the graph itself. Okay? So if you have a labeled graph, labeled with as follows, then the contribution corresponding to it is, well, since here you have a vertex, you have a lambda I1, J1, K1. So this is the first factor contributing. Since here you have another vertex, you'll have a lambda I2, J2, K2. And then, since here you have an edge, you should be getting a lambda upper alpha 1, alpha beta, upper beta 1. But alpha 1 is equal to I1, and beta 1 is equal to I2. So you get lambda I1, I2, and then lambda J1, J2 from the second one, and lambda K1, K2 from the third one. And overall, if you have a graph, it's clear how to turn it into an algebraic expression. So if I had a more complicated graph, say
say, I don't know, this one.
How do I turn it? What do I find? How do I find the corresponding contribution? Well, I label this I1, J1, K1. I label this one I2, J2, K2. I label this one I3, J3, K3, and so on. And then the contribution corresponding to it is a lambda I, J, K, or I1, J1, K1 for each internal, for each vertex, so lambda I2, J2, K2 for the second vertex and so on. And then for each edge, you get a lambda inverse. So a lambda J1 I2 for this edge, a lambda K1, J3 for the second edge, and so on. Okay? But then there is combinatorics. The graphs are born with the labels on them. But since the labels are really dummy variables, summation variables, the end result depends only on the graph. So you can turn everything to a sum over unmarked graphs, but then you have to be careful to count the labels correct, to count in how many ways an unmarked graph can be labeled, and this turns out to change the combinatorics a little bit, but you know, the details are not too important. Are you with me? Are you with me, or should I blame Pascal? So again, it's messy combinatorics, but at the end you get a sum over graphs. For each graph, you get an expression.
So what is this big epsilon d?
Epsilon d is the it's not epsilon, it's calligraphic e.
Right.
It's the expression corresponding to the diagram. The expression corresponding to the diagram is what I've defined here. Given a diagram, this is how you write an expression out of it.
Okay.
Okay? Good. So now, well, ignore the combinatorial details, and now we want to do the same to Chern-Simons theory. And, well, the first thought is that it's hell. But this is the hell that the physicists live with all the time, and this is what people do in Feynman diagrams. But really, it's not so bad. So, maybe it is quite bad, but that's sort of hard mathematics. But anyway, had there not been the knot, had the trace here not been, had this term not been around, this would be a precise analog of what we did, except in infinite dimensions. So, right, this is a quadratic, and this is a cubic. So, it's an analog. Now, so the result would be a sum over diagrams, where each diagram, maybe I will not make it too round because I don't want it to sound like the skeleton of the knot. So each diagram means a certain expression. Now, what is the expression corresponding to a diagram like this? So the vertices come from the cubic part. The cubic part is an integral over R3 of something which has sort of combinatorial description in terms of how indices contract together. Let's ignore this. The main point is that the cubic part is an integral over R3. So it's a big sum over all the points of R3. Okay? So, correspondingly, we should have a summation over the points of R3 for each vertex. So each vertex will contribute an integration on R3. So this will become an integral over R3. And this will become an integral over a second copy of R3. Because, well, before we had an independent summation for each instance of the cubic variables of the cubic form. Okay, and then for each internal edge, you should use the inverse of the one form of the quadratic part. The quadratic part is a differential operator, is defined by a differential operator, the operator D. Now, the inverses of differential operators are Green functions. So, on each edge, corresponding to each edge, there should be some Green function, some D inverse, which is really some two-variable Green function. And then, the corresponding expression will be constructed schematically and ignoring all the details by taking two integrations for each edge and a Green function for each, sorry, an integration for each vertex and a Green function for each edge. Okay? Now, this is without this term. This term is just an additional polynomial. Now, when I did the description of Gaussian integration, I did it without an additional polynomial, but I could have added here another polynomial just as well. Right? Instead of just using here the powers of the quadratic, I could have added another polynomial piece. Another polynomial piece would just mean another vertex to this picture. So I could have added, so I could have looked at pictures which are slightly more complicated. So they have one extra vertex, which is special. Now, that extra vertex is conventionally blown up and written in infinity, at infinity. So that extra vertex is in fact the circle of the knot. And I get diagrams inside this circle, and such diagrams are interpreted by interpreting each internal vertex as an integration on R3, because these are the vertices that I just described. Each edge, so this becomes an integral on R, this becomes an integral on R3, this is an integral on R3. Now, and each edge becomes a Green function, so some function LXY, this way becomes also a Green function, this becomes also a Green function, and then there is some complicated rule of how to construct an expression out of these ingredients. And finally, I have to tell you what the external vertex means, the vertex at infinity, the knot itself means. So the knot itself comes from this holonomy, and the holonomy is a big product. But when you take a big product, 1 plus m times 1 plus m times 1 plus m times 1 plus m and so on, you can expand it, and you get, well, the first order term is just 1. The second order term is the sum of all the m's. The third order term is a product of pair of m's which are ordered from left to right. The next term is a product of triples and so on. And now the m's really correspond to the points of the knot. So really here I have integration over, so each of these variables corresponds to one of the m's, and you get integrations over S1 for each one. And this looks more or less like the configuration space integral that I described before. Now comes a huge affair, which is, well, maybe I'll start from with the monsters that I left in backwards order. So first of all, you have to assemble everything. So I told you the schematics, but you have to turn it into precise details. You have to compute what L inverse is. You have to figure out the details of how to construct these expressions. When you do all of this assembly process, you get precisely the configuration space integrals that I started from. But this is a bit of a lie, because D inverse doesn't really exist. So when you invert an invertible differential operator, the result is a Green function. But the exterior derivative is certainly not invertible, because it has a huge kernel. So this was a bit of a lie already here. So then there is a whole procedure of, suppose you want to do Gaussian integration in the presence of an invariance with respect to some big group. So suppose you want to integrate over a space, but the integrand is invariant under some group. Then the invariance under the group corresponds to degeneracy of the quadratic, makes the quadratic cannot be non-degenerate, so you cannot invert it. But on the other hand, since you have invariant under the group, you don't have to integrate over the whole space. It's enough if you choose a section and integrate over the section. But then the section doesn't intersect all the orbits in the same way, so you have to multiply by some determinant. And you have to develop a theory for integrating the determinants. And it turns out that the result of this theory is exactly the same. You get precisely what you want to get. And then I didn't tell you about universality. I didn't tell you where the framing anomaly comes from. I didn't really prove invariance, and I didn't even prove convergence. But I only promised a sketch. Okay. That's all I had to say.
Questions? Oscar?
Yeah, to summarize your Gaussian integration, so that's sort of a combinatorial trick. To summarize, it's a combinatorial trick to compute the integral of an exponential quadratic and cubic.
Yeah.
Is what you say.
So the integral of an, basically, the integral of an, ex, of a, if the exponential of a quadratic plus a cubic can be evaluated. And the formula for the evaluation involves, well, you know, originally you had an integral. But it can be evaluated in terms of sums, which run from 1 to n, where n is the dimension. Now, suppose the dimension is continuum. Namely, your integrand, instead of being, you know, the integration variable, instead of being a column vector of length finite, it's in itself a function. It has a value at each point. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Then you pretend that the same formula works. I mean, in fact, the upper thing doesn't have a definition, but the formula makes sense. And instead of summation from 1 to n for each of the variables that appear here, you get integration over the space of points, over this continuum. So each Feynman diagram instead of corresponding to some multiple summation, becomes a multiple integration. But it's multiple finite integration. And that's the whole trick. But you see, so this is more or less well defined. The end result of the process is more or less well defined. Well, at least it's you get well defined formulas, but they don't evaluate any integral, because the integral you started from have no meaning. So these formulas become, if you want, the definition of that integral. Mm-hmm. So you have to prove all the properties from scratch. Mm-hmm. If you had a priori reasons to think that this integral should define not invariance, well, you have to throw away these a priori reasons and prove invariance from the formula. Okay, if you had a priori reasons to think that things converge, well, you have to throw away those reasons and prove that the convergence at this level. And all of these things are challenging and, you know, take a good semester for. Yes?
You showed us how the configuration space appears, and what about the integrand? Is it easy to see how?
So the integrand is a combination of these green functions with similar green functions that arise when you try to compute the determinants, the corresponding determinants that occur here. And when you look at them, they turn out to be these pullbacks of volume forms. You can rewrite them as pullbacks of volume forms. I don't know if I should give an exercise, but you know, there is a very simple formula for D inverse, for N inverse of the exterior derivative. So of course there is no unique inverse, there is no, but and it's not always defined. But if you have a form which you know has, so basically there is a very simple formula for the inverse of the exterior derivative when it makes sense, in terms of pullbacks of volume forms of S1. So if you want, I'll show you. I don't think it makes sense right now.
Any more questions? Okay, so tomorrow's lecture is at 3.